loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, Director of National Intelligence Dan Coats said yesterday that Russia is still trying to interfere in U.S. elections, despite noting no infrastructure interference. Meanwhile, mainstream media is writing hit pieces on Maria Butina's character, saying that she has, quote, an overly flirtatious approach, unquote. Next, the Wall Street Journal is reporting that Trump donor Franklin Haney apparently agreed to pay Trump attorney Michael Cohen a $10 million finder's fee if Cohen could successfully lobby for the building of an unfinished nuclear power plant in Alabama. The new information is part of a federal investigation into Cohen's unregistered lobbying activities. He had bragged to potential clients about his access to Trump. Then, with all 10 provinces counted, Zimbabweans have elected Emmerson Mnangagwa president with 50.8% of the vote. Opposition leader Nelson Chamisa was second with 44.3%. Outside observers say the election was free and fair, but Chamisa is disputing this and refuses to concede. And then the Chinese government said today that it would impose as much as $60 billion in new tariffs if the U.S. goes forward with its own threatened tariffs against China. The Chinese tariffs would cut across all sectors and would be a 25% duty on meat, coffee, nuts, alcohol, minerals, chemicals, leather and wood, machinery, furniture, and even auto parts. And finally, it's Friday, so we'll look at the week's worst and most misleading headlines. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. Now we turn to the Russia investigation. Director of National Intelligence Dan Coats said yesterday that Russia is still trying to interfere in U.S. elections. Donald Trump, however, said three times yesterday that the Russia investigation is a witch hunt, his words. Tellingly, though, Coats also said that he had no idea why the president didn't condemn this alleged Russian meddling during his meeting in Helsinki with Russian President Vladimir Putin. We'll figure this out with Ted Rawl, who joins us from New York. Ted is an award-winning editorial cartoonist and columnist. Welcome, Ted.
Thank you, guys.
Ted, let's listen to Dan Coats' statement yesterday. There are 20 different ways to parse this thing, but let's listen to it and then try to figure out what he meant.
We continue to see a pervasive messaging campaign by Russia to try to weaken and divide the United States. These efforts are not exclusive to this election or future elections, but certainly cover issues relevant to the election. We also know the Russians try to hack into and steal information from candidates and government officials alike.
Okay, is that news in any way?
No. What is news is really just, I guess, the dull repetition of linguistic tricks that we've seen from government officials in this and previous administrations, which are made to sound dramatic unless you really pay close attention. I think they're counting on the fact that the average American works 54 hours a week and they're just getting a quick headline and they're not paying close attention. But when you do, just listen to them and take them at face value. There's really no there.
You know, I want to go over those words and do just what Ted Rawl says most Americans don't have time to do. Because even if you don't just hear the headline, if you hear Coates talking, but you've been already sort of set up, the context has been created that this is about Russian meddling. You think, oh, the CIA or the Director of National Intelligence is confirming that this is, in fact, Russian intelligence. So these are what he just said. We continue to see a pervasive messaging campaign by Russia to try to weaken and divide the United States. These efforts are not exclusive to this election or future elections, but certainly cover issues relevant to the United States. Now, what that means, Ted Rawl, and I see you have an upcoming cartoon about this, is that the Russian investigation has degenerated or devolved into just this. Russians are talking about Black Lives Matter. Russians are talking about abortion rights. Russians or Russian media or Russian memes, and we don't know what Russian means anymore. Is it the Russian government? Is it Russian people? Is it the IRA, the Internet Research Agency, troll farm in St. Petersburg? Whatever. It doesn't matter. Russians is just a big, you know, unitary entity now called Russians, and all things are directed by the Kremlin, presumably. What they're really saying here is by supporting issues that matter to Americans or having an opinion on issues that matter to American. Russia is, in fact, now involved in spreading chaos in America, disrupting American democracy and American society. So there's actually nothing Russia can say about anything, and nothing any of us who are activists, let's say you're a peace activist or a Black Lives Matter activist, you now sort of have to hold your hand up and say before you begin your own advocacy, oh, by the way, even though I care about racism in America, I'm not a Kremlin agent.
You know, it's a funny thing about the U.S. Constitution. It actually applies to non-citizens within the United States, anyone who's traveling here, even undocumented workers and so on. And so literally what they're arguing, I think what they're implying, is that the First Amendment does not apply within the United States to countries that the United States deems to be as they call it, an adversary, if not necessarily an enemy, since an enemy is a country that you are at war with. And the thing is, it's very peculiar. I mean, are they saying that, for example, if the BBC publishes or runs a piece about Black Lives Matter, that they are interfering with American elections? I mean, it follows logically that they are saying that. But it's, of course, no, they wouldn't say that because it's absurd. It reminds me a lot of when, during the run-up to the Iraq War, when the Bush-Cheney administration kept saying that Iraq was engaged in terrorism. And when you scratch the surface of that, what they meant was that Saddam Hussein offered to pay the victims, the families of people who worked at Hezbollah, families of Hezbollah attackers, to pay for the families' survivors. And so, you know, the thing is that Hezbollah never attacked the United States. And most Americans don't know that Saddam Hussein never supported any anti-American Islamist terrorism. To the contrary, they were opponents of it. So, but the thing is that Americans didn't dig that deep. They just heard terrorism. It was after 9/11, and that was good enough, and they got to define it. It's very Orwellian.
Yeah, we had the New York Times headline from the other day, Facebook busts shadowy plot to jolt elections. Now, here you have Dan Coates saying, it's not about the elections really anymore. It's about messaging, pervasive messaging about anything.
Right.
Anything that's a, quote, divisive issue.
And that pervasive messaging includes Sputnik and RT and anything else that the U.S. government doesn't like. Throw it into a heap that you call outside agitation or propaganda, and then you rally people against it.
Yeah. Again, if our show and the content of our show was on, you know, that war supporting channel called CNN,
right,
then it would be like, cool. If it's on Sputnik, then we're part of a shadowy plot, even though everybody can hear this shadowy plot every day, Monday through Friday, 4 to 6 p.m. at 105.5 FM. And we say the things that we've been saying before and will continue to say after Sputnik. Go ahead.
And what's really interesting is that nobody disputes the truth of what's being said. It reminds me of the Hillary emails and the DNC emails that were that were leaked, and we talked about it earlier on this show, where allegedly that's an interference with elections. Look, the fact is that the vast majority of Americans, when they hear Russians interfered with or hacked the election, what they think of is the Russian intelligence services hacking into electronic voting machines and boards of elections in order to change the returns in favor of Donald Trump or anyone else that the Russian government would prefer to win. That's what Americans think of. And this is not even close to that. It's not even a relative of that. It's not a second cousin of it. It's not in the same universe as that. And I think this is really the huge weight, gaping chasm between what they're implying and what's actually going on is so vast that even Americans who are in a big hurry can tell the difference and are shrugging their shoulders, which is why fewer than 1% of Americans tell pollsters they really care about this Russiagate thing.
Ted, I'm not aware of any of those things that Americans, as I agree with you, think that's what it means for Russia. I mean, there's the issue of, did the Russians vis-a-vis WikiLeaks or vice versa hack the DNC servers or, you know, the Podesta emails, right? But did, I mean, I'm not aware of any, there was that Vermont story about Russia was hacking into the Vermont electric grid, which was bogus. Are there, was there anything in 2016 that the government is saying Russia actually did in that regard?
No, there's no allegation whatsoever. In fact, to the contrary, the intelligence community has been extremely clear for anyone who chooses to read it and Google it that nothing like that of the sort has happened. In fact, during yesterday's hearings, that subject came up, and it was stated very clearly that there's no evidence that Russia ever actually hacked any boards of elections or any voting machines.
Ted Rall, let's listen to Christopher Wray, the director of the FBI, from yesterday's election, because what you're saying and what we're saying doesn't comport with what he generalized at the hearing. Let's listen to this audio clip from Christopher Wray.
In the context of 2018, we are not yet seeing the same kind of efforts to specifically target election infrastructure, you know, voter registration databases in particular. What we are seeing are the malign influence operations, in effect, information warfare that we've talked about, and that didn't really, that's a 24/7, 365 days a year phenomenon that doesn't turn necessarily on whether or not we're in the middle of an election season or not. But as Director Coates said, Any moment is just a moment before, you know, the dial can be turned up one, much as we saw in 2016. Again, not in terms of affecting the vote count, but in terms of potential penetration of voter registration databases or something like that. And that, in turn, can be a vehicle for them to try to sow discord or undermine confidence. And we have to make sure we're pushing back on it, which is what we're doing.
Go ahead, Ted. That was Christopher Wray, FBI director, speaking yesterday.
The sowing discord, amplifying divisions in American society, you know, it's all very united we stand. It's very propagandistic. It doesn't really stand up to intellectual scrutiny, though, does it? I mean, it doesn't make much sense.
Yeah, and again, if you have to parse those words carefully to see that Christopher Wray seems to be suggesting that the Russians did it in 2016, hacked infrastructure, but aren't doing it in 2018. But when you really listen to those words, he's actually not making that assertion. Anyway, John, I think we're completely out of time.
We are out of time. We were joined from New York by Ted Rall. Ted is an award-winning editorial cartoonist and columnist. We have a lot more coming up. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou in studio with my co-host Brian Becker. The Wall Street Journal is reporting that Trump donor Franklin Haney apparently agreed to pay Trump attorney Michael Cohen a $10 million finder's fee if Cohen could successfully lobby for the building of an unfinished nuclear power plant in Alabama. The new information is part of a federal investigation into Cohen's unregistered lobbying activities. He had bragged to potential clients about his access to Trump. We're joined in studio by Kevin Camps, the radioactive waste watchdog at the organization Beyond Nuclear. And we're also joined by Nicole Russell. She's one of the producers of this show. Welcome to both of you.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks.
Kevin, before we get to this, though, you have breaking news that's important and is actually a scoop in that nobody else is reporting it. So what's going on?
Well, I'm on the board of directors of Don't Waste Michigan, which is the statewide anti-nuclear coalition up there in the Great Lakes. And one of our watchdogs who closely monitors the goings-on at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, the daily download of voluminous numbers of documents at the website of the NRC, found one a couple days ago that caught his eye. He looked into it, and it turns out, yet again, there's another secretive shipment of high-level radioactive waste being proposed. It would originate at a nuclear power plant in Illinois called LaSalle, and it would go to Port Huron, Michigan. There's no clear answers as to what is being shipped exactly, why it's being shipped, where it's going. And so our coalition of anti-nuclear watchdogs across the Great Lakes region, from Illinois to Indiana to Michigan to Ohio to Ontario, are asking a lot of questions about why are these high risks being taken?
You know, I noticed in the press release, too, you're one of the signatories on the press release, that it's talking about the possibility of a water route. That's not a normal route, is it?
Well, it is potential. Barge shipments are potential with these. These are very heavy loads, for one thing. If they use a rail size cask, we don't even know for sure how big the cask is going to be. There is talk of a truck route. That would be a smaller sized cask. But if they use the rail sized, these things can weigh over 100 tons. And so you can't take that down the interstate very easily. So if they do transfer from truck to barge, they could do it for various reasons, ease of shipment, or because of the weight of the container. And sure enough, Port Huron is right on the St. Clair River. It's also on Lake Huron. Depending on where this is going, to Canada or even overseas perhaps, that may be why they transfer it to a boat. And the dangers are significant with a boat. If the boat were to sink, the containers approved by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission have inadequate design criteria.
That was my next question, actually. What happens if it sinks? What happens if there's an accident?
Well, if the container's damaged and water can get into the container and a critical mass forms in the high-level radioactive waste, there's enough fissile material in there, plutonium-239, uranium-235, that in the presence of a neutron moderator like water, just like in an atomic reactor core, you could spark a chain reaction. That would make the releases worse to the Great Lakes, which is drinking water for 40 million people in two countries. But it would also make emergency response a suicide mission at that point because of the gamma and neutron radiation coming off of the inadvertent nuclear chain reaction.
So, Kevin, we have you on every Wednesday on our segment Beyond Nuclear, and we've talked a lot about the NRC. But despite all of our conversations about the NRC, I am still just sitting here in shock that, you know, you all had to comb through 467 documents to be able to even find this proposed route, which indicates to me that this could be happening any day, every day. We have no idea. We also, you know, there are already so many routes like this that aren't safe, that are, you know, potentials for dirty bombs, we know, for radioactive waste getting out of those containers, for if there are trucks in accidents, or if there are, you know, any, there's so many ways that this can be really disastrous for the people that this is being transported through, these neighborhoods that these are being transported through. But I am just really struck by the kind of secrecy around this process. Can you talk a little bit more about, like, when would we find out about this if it gets approved? Like, would the public have comment? What would happen with that process?
Well, some of these watchdogs, like Michael Keegan with Coalition for Nuclear Free Great Lakes, he's about 40 years into this work. He's really good at what he does. He monitors daily the NRC website, and he catches these things sometimes. But it was obscurely titled. It was buried under a mountain of other documents. We're very busy on many battlefronts. And just to give you another example, the same coalition of groups, and like I said, many of us have been doing this for decades. I'm a newcomer, and I've been doing it for 25 years. So back in November of 2001, when we were on top guard, we were being as vigilant as possible because the Yucca Mountain votes in the Congress were coming up any time then. They came up the next spring. So we were watching for nuclear waste shipments, and they snuck one past us anyway. Despite all of our watchdogging, it was two radioactive steam generators from the Kewaunee Nuclear Power Plant in Wisconsin that were sent by boat through Chicago waterways down the Mississippi River to Tennessee. They did that overnight and secretly, and we didn't find out about that until about 9 years later when a Canadian nuclear power plant was proposing to do the same thing. We got a lot more people involved, and Senator Feingold from Wisconsin, who was serving at the time, demanded documents from NRC. And in that document released by NRC, we found out about a shipment that had happened 9 years earlier. And what's really humorous about it all is NRC likes to brag about how transparent they are.
But I mean, going through the Chicago waterways, it's one of the major metropolitan cities of this entire country. I mean, that's insane.
Well, that is considered by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and the industry a low-level radioactive waste shipment, even though it was highly radioactive. But what we're talking about today, this new proposal that they're considering right now that's so mysterious, is irradiated nuclear fuel. It's highly radioactive waste, even in their own categorization. And John had asked about barge shipments. Well, under the Yucca Mountain Plan, under the New Mexico and Texas temporary storage site plans, there is the real potential for up to 450 barge shipments on Lake Michigan. And they wouldn't go into the port of Chicago. They'd go into the port of Milwaukee and the port of Muskegon in Michigan. Any one of those going down could poison not only Lake Michigan, but other Great Lakes downstream and put the drinking water for 40 million people at risk.
Well, let's turn to, so this is the result essentially of having so many nuclear power plants in the country and so much fuel being put into those plants and so much waste coming out of those plants. And, you know, the original reason we wanted to talk to you today was about really some really nasty political maneuvers that have gone on in the past couple of years that have caused this, you know, so many plants to be able to be built up. So Michael Cohen, Trump's former attorney, it sounds like took $10 million from someone to be able to get a government or to be able to insure this this investor, this nuclear owner, a government loan of $5 billion. Can you tell us a little bit more about the story and how prevalent these kinds of payments are?
Well, the Wall Street Journal broke the story, and you've got the figures right. Michael Cohen was being offered a $10 million success fee if the money came through, and it would be dialed down depending on how much money this nuclear entrepreneur, a billionaire named Franklin Haney, got from the U.S. Department of Energy in the form of a nuclear loan guarantee. And a lot of our groups fought this program from the start back in the early days of the Bush-Cheney administration when the nuclear loan guarantee program was hatched in the first place. And according to the Wall Street Journal article, which interviewed lobbyists in D.C. and professors at American University, this kind of dealing and the amounts of money involved are very unusual.
Very unusual. You can look through lobbyist registrations and see that a lobbyist in the course of a year will make, you know, anywhere from $50 from a client to a couple of hundred thousand. Never in my life have I seen a $10 million retainer or success fee. It's astounding.
And, you know, there is a loan guarantee that first the Obama administration and then the Trump administration have granted already to two nuclear plants under construction in Georgia called Vogtle Units 3 and 4. So Obama gave $8.3 billion. Trump topped it up, and now it's $12 billion. That was another $3-plus billion that Trump gave overnight out of nowhere. And so there is this stuff going on. Incredibly, Obama's energy secretary, who was serving at the time that $8.3 billion taxpayer-backed nuclear loan guarantee was awarded to Southern Nuclear in Georgia, now sits on the board of Southern Nuclear. So it's worked very well for Ernest Moniz. But here we go. This one is even darker and more sinister because, for one thing, Cohen is not registered as a lobbyist. If he was, maybe it would be legal. Certainly not ethical, but he's not registered. So this was all being done secretly. And it's not the first we've heard. Back in May, the Wall Street Journal again broke the story that Cohen was involved in this realm, but there were only bits and pieces. And one of the bits that we knew in May, but now there's more details, is that not only was the Department of Energy being applied to for this massive $5 billion nuclear loan guarantee, which is taxpayer money. If it goes belly up and they default on their loan repayment, the taxpayers are out that money. But there was also a pitch made with Cohen's involvement to a Qatari prince. This is a Qatari foreign investment fund. And the whole affair, or at least the overnight, involved the yacht of Franklin Haney. And I do believe that Franklin Haney anchors his yacht in Southwest D.C. from time to time, if not most of the time. So, yeah.
There's been a lot of controversy around Michael Cohen recently. You know, some, you know, kind of extra dramatized, some clearly really, really fair and, you know, really problematic if those things are true. And this really strikes me as one of the latter. I mean, this is Trump's personal attorney. This is not like, you know, some sort of, you know, counsel. This is not someone who's there to give him policy advice. This is his personal attorney. This is like a friend, essentially, or also someone who has a lot of information on him. It's a ridiculously unethical thing, even to your point, even if it is legal, which it probably isn't, given that he's not registered as a lobbyist.
And it looks like April was Nuclear Fools Month in the Trump administration, because that was when he had a private dinner with the top lobbyist, Jeff Miller from First Energy in Akron, Ohio, who used to be Rick Perry's campaign manager for president, seeking what's turned out to be, all told, a $34 billion per year federal subsidy. So that's ratepayers and taxpayers to prop up old nuke and coal plants in not only Ohio and Pennsylvania, but maybe the whole country.
Well, we can leave it there. We were joined here in the studio by Kevin Camps, the radioactive waste watchdog at the organization Beyond Nuclear. And our own producer, Nicole Roussel, also joined us in the studio. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
With all 10 provinces counted, Zimbabweans have elected Emmerson Mnangagwa president with 50.8% of the vote. Opposition leader Nelson Chamisa was second with 44.3%. Outside observers say the election was free and fair, but Chamisa is disputing this and refuses to concede. We're joined from Houston by Dr. Gerald Horn, a professor of history at the University of Houston and the author of many books, including Blows Against the Empire, U.S. Imperialism in Crisis. Dr. Horn, it seems that this was a free and fair election. There are soldiers in the streets now. We know that they forcibly dispersed a group of journalists during the night, and then Mnangagwa urged calm. What exactly are we looking at in the next day or two in Zimbabwe?
It's hard to say, but it's a well-known fact that the losing opposition, the Movement for Democratic Change, is backed by the United States and its North Atlantic allies. And undoubtedly, they feel that they can take it to the streets and get support, because it's no secret that the United States is not happy with the result of this election. They wanted to see the ouster of the ruling party, ZANU-PF, which prevailed in this election, not least because the ruling party struck a blow against the kith and kin of those who dominate in Washington. I'm speaking of the European minority who had controlled the land until land reform some years ago, which led to devastating sanctions against Zimbabwe and the portrayal of Zimbabwe in the U.S. press as the epitome of human rights violations, which, of course, seems to and serves to obscure even worse situations in neighboring countries like Equatorial Guinea, like Cameroon, for example, like Swaziland, for example. So the situation in that part of Africa, as we speak, is unclear.
I'm wondering, too, if this is all part of the bigger Western plan to keep the country unstable and easily controlled. You know, is democracy a bad thing in the eyes of the West? Democracy in Zimbabwe?
Well, certainly, because democracy does not present the outcome that the United States helped to try to engineer. That is to say, the ouster of the ruling party and the installation of the opposition. We know that there are long memories in Washington. They have not forgiven the Haitian revolutionaries who between 1791 and 1804 helped to oust slavery and slave owners, helping to engineer a general crisis of the entire slave system in the Americas that led to that system's collapse in the United States of America itself. Haiti since that time has been punished and pulverized by the United States of America. The ZANU-PF inflicted a mighty blow against settler colonialism by expropriating the land, that is to say, taking the fruits of settler colonialism. This was a not-so-subtle message to the settler colonial regime number one in North America that it too could suffer reversals. But more to the point, it was also a signal to neighboring South Africa and neighboring Namibia that they too should move along the path of ousting the European minority from controlling the land, which has led to a slogan, by the way, that we would do well to observe on this side of the Atlantic. I'm speaking of the South African slogan directed at the land owners, expropriation without compensation, EWC. We would do well to direct that slogan at the 1% here in North America.
Yeah, and they'd still be getting along perfectly fine, given the fact that, say, I don't know, Bill Gates, Mark Zuckerberg, they have like $150 billion. So, yeah. Dr. Horn, you know, I was looking back at that study. It's now a little bit famous in recent times. It's done by Dove Levin at the Carnegie Mellon University about how the U.S. has intervened indirectly and directly 81 times between 1946 and the year 2000, according to a database amassed by Levin. Intervened in other people's elections. And Levin defines intervention as a costly act which is designed to determine the election results in favor of one of two sides. And this doesn't count all the regime change overthrows, coup d'etats that the CIA led after the U.S. side, the pro-U.S. side or the U.S. backside didn't win the election. But there's another part to this question of interference. Whether the U.S. directly intervenes through the National Endowment for Democracy or CIA covert operations or whatever. There's the other larger picture, which is all countries in the world, and especially developing countries, in order to trade, to do business, to get what they need to sustain life in their country, they have to be integrated into the world economy. And the U.S., by virtue of credit and by virtue of employing sanctions, can have a profound impact immiserating a country that would otherwise do very, very well. And that, too, then redounds badly for whoever the incumbent is. Let's talk about how that's impacted Zimbabwe.
Well, as you know, Zimbabwe is a storehouse of minerals, particularly chrome. And you may recall that during the Liberation War between 1965 and 1980, the United States arranged for the importation of chrome from the racist, rebellious regime of then leader Ian Smith. But now, with African majority rule, sanctions have been slapped on the nation, which helps to hinder the ability of Zimbabwe to export its precious minerals. Coming to the rescue to a degree was the People's Republic of China, helping to present a kind of alternative framework, that is to say, a framework that put forward a challenger to the World Bank with regard to funding of infrastructural development. But now you see the United States has launched a trade war against China designed to weaken China so that this alternative framework that China is spearheading will no longer be a challenger to the framework dominated by the United States and its Washington-based institutions such as the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. The end result is that nations like Zimbabwe find it difficult to exercise sovereignty in light of this U.S.-dominated framework that is strangling independence and sovereignty.
Zimbabwe is not one of the leading, let's say, the leading political voices in Africa. Certainly, South Africa is. So do you think that other important, heavily populated members of the Organization of African Unity are going to come to Mnangagwa's aid here and speak out in support of this election and in opposition to Western attempts to influence it in any way? Or is he on his own in this?
No, I don't think that ZANU-PF is on his own. Recall that under a previous South African president, Thabo Mbeki, he was under tremendous pressure to intervene in Zimbabwe's internal affairs. In fact, Nobel laureate Desmond Tutu, who we had thought was a man of peace, had actually called for his nation, South Africa, to invade Zimbabwe and engage in regime change.
Good grief.
The fact that the Southern African Development Community, which encompasses both Zimbabwe and South Africa, has given a thumbs up with regard to the free and fair nature of this election helps to reassure some of us that the neighbors of Zimbabwe will stand by the side of Zimbabwe. And I should also say that one of the reasons why this election result turned out the way that it did was because of votes in the countryside. That is to say, it's no secret that the opposition has a stronghold in the urban areas where electoral observers tend to flock, speaking of the capital, Harare, and city number 2, Bulawayo. But the countryside is where the bulk of the population resides, and that's where the European minority for decades shamelessly and cruelly exploited the Zimbabwean peasantry. The peasantry has long memories, which is why they probably cast a vote in favor of ZANU-PF, even though they too may have had reservations about the ultimate trajectory of that party.
We're speaking with Dr. Gerald Horn. Dr. Horn is the author of many books. I'm looking, Dr. Horn, at one of your books. It's from UNC Press, authored by you or published by you in 2001. The title is From the Barrel of a Gun, The United States and the War Against Zimbabwe. What was the goal of the United States war against Zimbabwe? What was it really? And have the political objectives shifted or altered since 1980?
I think that the objective was to preserve the rebellion of the settler colonial regime led by Ian Smith. Ian Smith, when he rebelled against Britain's move towards African majority rule in November 1965, said that he was echoing the settler colonial revolt of what eventuated as the United States of America in July 1776. also a revolt against London, that time on the basis of London moving towards the abolition of slavery in June 1772 in Somerset's case. The point is that, as I detail in that book, the United States was not a neutral or passive observer during the Liberation War, 1965 to 1980. The United States regime looked the other way when hundreds, perhaps thousands, of U.S. mercenaries, Euro-American mercenaries, I might add, flocked to Southern Africa to fight with rifle in hand against the idea of African majority rule. And then after they were defeated ignominiously, many of them then decamped to South Africa, where they tried to stop African majority rule there, which came, as you know, in the spring of 1994, with some of them returning to the United States of America. And I would dare say that they are now supporting the current occupant of the Oval Office, one Donald J. Trump.
That was the voice of Dr. Gerald Horn. He joined us from Houston. Dr. Horn is a professor of history at the University of Houston and author of many books, including Blows Against the Empire, U.S. Imperialism in Crisis. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
The Chinese government said today that it would impose as much as $60 billion in new tariffs if the U.S. goes forward with its own threatened tariffs against China. The Chinese tariffs would cut across all sectors and would be a 25% duty on meat, coffee, nuts, alcohol, minerals, chemicals, leather and wood, machinery, furniture, and even auto parts. We're joined from London by Steve Keen, the author of Debunking Economics, and the world's first crowdfunded economist. You can check out his work at patreon.com/ Prof. Steve Keen, K-E-E-N. Steve, welcome back to the show.
Great to be here, mate.
Steve, Donald Trump said a little more than a year ago that trade wars are easy and they're easily winnable. Well, this has been dragging on for some time and it's starting to have an impact on the U.S. economy. Where do we go from here?
I think it just escalates, frankly, because the American capacity to not know what happened yesterday is breathtaking. The Chinese capacity to remember what happened a century ago is equally breathtaking. And in many ways, the Chinese now have got the level of pride building once more that they used to have back in their civilization before the barbarians came in and flattened it. The Americans aren't, if the Americans are at all aware of the Opium War, they probably think they were fighting a war to stop the spread of opium in China. In fact, they were fighting a war along with the British to allow the British to sell opium to China because there's nothing else that England made that the Chinese wanted. So the English, with the help of the Americans and French, fought to keep opium sales open in China. Now, the attitude that we were raped by the Europeans and we're going to get even, you don't want to provoke that, but that is what is actually happening. And I think this, the Chinese are applying to the brazenness of Trump with their own rather more well-founded long-term brazenness.
Steve Keen, the Chinese government said that the real point of Trump's tariffs and Trump's trade war is to stop China's peaceful development. Those are their words.
I'd agree with that. Now that's the interesting thing is the Chinese quite consciously exploited loopholes in the American tariff laws to start their industrialization process back in the early 1980s. And what's happening here is that because that's been a successful project, what you've had is a dramatic industrialization of China, a total transformation of the country ever since Deng Xiaoping. They are now an industrial powerhouse, and they intend continuing to rise. So it's rather, in some ways, it's trying to shut the gate after the horse has bolted. But fundamentally, yes, that's what America is trying to do. And I think the support for this goes well beyond Trump's normal political circle.
Yeah, it's not just economics.
Steve, I think one of the things that most Americans don't understand is that U.S.-China trade amounts to some $650 billion a year, and that's the largest trading relationship in the world between two countries. But the Chinese export far more goods to the U.S. than vice versa. How hard is it going to be for the Chinese to target enough American products or enough American sectors to make this hurt enough to bring the U.S. back to the table?
I don't think they can do much in that front. I think it's going to be more symbolic in their capacity to take pain that matters, because they'll face higher prices for some of the things they import from America, and they'll see that as a badge of national pride to wear that pain. That's not the way Americans tend to behave. If you start cutting back on the capacity of soybean exporters to export. You're likely to get demonstrations. I guess you get them in Kansas. So there'll be a different nature in the way in which they respond. But I think the important thing for the long term is that China still imports a large number of highly elaborately processed machines from America. In particular, of course, they've got to import Intel processors to be able to produce the cheap computers they sell back to America. Now, if this war escalates, one thing I'm sure the Chinese will do is say, okay, rather than building another high-speed rail, or in addition to building another high-speed rail, we're going to try to finance somebody like Foxconn to start establishing our own integrated circuit production process. Now, that's not straightforward, it's not easy, but it will provoke China to become even more self-sufficient as an industrial nation than it is right now.
Yeah, and that's another ethos of the Chinese government. They said, and again, I'm paraphrasing, but it's a virtual quote, what we believe is that it's possible to turn a bad thing into a good thing, a sort of a cliche, but nonetheless, something that you can see China embracing as an argument for more self-reliance, not reliant on Western companies who in the past promised as a quid pro quo, you give us access to this vast market, China, 1.2 billion or 1.3 billion people. You let us develop. You let us come in and set up shop and hire Chinese labor at lower wages than the labor in the United States or elsewhere. We get maximum profits, maybe super profits. In return, you get business. You get integrated into the world economy. You have some level of technology transfer. That was the quid pro quo, but no. If the U.S. is sort of reneging on the basic quid pro quo and saying, no, actually what we're trying to do is stop your development as a nation, then China has to move in the direction of self-reliance. I mean, because everything else becomes so, so unstable.
That's right. And the thing is, if America had done this 20 years ago, it would have worked, because at that stage, you didn't have enough machine tool manufacturing capability, enough of the knowledge that's required to make those things function in China itself. Now, I think it was about a year ago, the head of Apple said that if you wanted to have a meeting of machine tool experts in America, he could hold it in his boardroom. If you want to hold the same meeting in China, you'd need a football stadium. And in that basis, it's actually America which has lost the capacity to develop highly transformed manufacturers. China's got that capacity built up now. If they have to extend it into another area, it will take time. It won't be easy, but they'll do it. And consequently, rather than having a slowdown in the rate of growth of China, you'd actually get additional investment coming out of this and perhaps a boost to the rate of growth.
I'm looking at the Wall Street Journal, John, from yesterday. Last night, this story came out. The headline is, let me pull the headline up. It says, kidney beans piled to the rafters. Tariffs are biting in farm country. It's a story from Wisconsin. After the U.S. placed tariffs on European steel and aluminum in June, Europe hit back with a tax that, among other things, made American kidney beans 25% more expensive in Europe. Now Cindy Brown is running out of room to store the beans. 1-ton bags of them cover the floors in her cavernous warehouses. Smaller sacks are piled on the wood pallet shelves. Kidney beans fill tall steel bins that dot the grounds. In other words, they're not selling. What's the impact, Steve? Will the U.S. government be able to sort of use subsidies as a way out? Or it sounds like for some people, it might not matter that much.
Oh, they'll manage. I mean, it's the capacity to create money is one of the simplest things on the planet. This is where so much economic analysis goes wrong, by treating it like something you've got to dig up and mine, and it's very hard to do. If the government decides to create that additional money, they can do it. And I think if you have this sort of war evolving, then what's going to happen in Congress, particularly with a chest-beating president like Trump, they'll see subsidizing the farmers as a matter of national security, and therefore there'll be no limits to the amount of subsidy they'll generate. If that involves a larger deficit, they'll do it. And ironically, out of this attempt to undermine China, you may have China industrializing in areas it doesn't currently cover, and therefore growing faster. And America, with a larger government deficit, getting more cash in circulation and more spending. So it'll be unstable. There'll be inflation for sure. But I think it'll actually potentially use an increase in growth in both countries rather than a slowdown, because they'll both be investing.
Steve, I wanted to ask you, too, the last round of tariffs specifically targeted states where Donald Trump won in 2016. Most of those states were agricultural states in the Midwest. These new proposed tariffs seem to cut across all industries, all across the country. Is that just happenstance, or is this thing devolving into something more serious?
I think it's more serious because, again, the Chinese pride, the desire to reassert the empire they used to have before they got destroyed by the colonials in the 1800s, that's the large part of the background thinking of anybody in the Communist Party in China, and particularly Xi. I mean, Xi is he's Donald Trump with a brain. Now, that's dangerous. And he's somebody who's quite capable of asserting the power they've got. This could come to something military. I think the islands they've built in the South China Sea may well be a scene where they will be willing to, you know, ban all American shipping that goes inside the channel they've created there. Something like that. We tend to forget that some time ago there was about 5 or 6 years ago, a similar level of angst was developing. Not the same scale, but angst between the two countries. And there was an American aircraft carrier coming into Hong Kong for R&R, and they wouldn't let the sailors off the boat.
Yeah, I think Steve is right. You know, when the Chinese Revolution succeeded, and Mao Zedong gave that famous speech October 1st, 1949, in Tiananmen Square, he didn't start by saying, "Now we're building the great, glorious future of socialism or communism." He made his argument, "China has now stood up," meaning overcoming the century of humiliation. And right now, what Trump is doing, irony of ironies or the unintended consequences, forcing China to go back and reassert its fundamental long-term plan, which is to emerge from underdevelopment imposed on China by Western powers and reclaim its rightful place in the world as a leading force. And Trump's policies, yeah, it may not backfire on him in the Farm Belt, but long-term, the United States will, instead of weakening China, will in fact, consequently, I think, strengthen China. Anyway, we're out of time. We were joined from London by Steve Keen. Steve is the author of Debunking Economics and the world's first crowdfunded economist. We urge you to show support for Steve because his work is amazing. And you can do that by going to patreon.com/prof/Steve Keen, and Keen is K-E-E-N. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
It's Friday, so we'll look at some of the week's worst and most misleading headlines. Joining us from the San Francisco Bay Area is Steve Pat. He's an independent journalist whose critiques of the mainstream media have been a feature of his blog, Left Eye on the News. Steve tweets at Left Eye Blog, LeftEyeBlog. And we're joined in studio by Sputnik News producer, Nicole Roussel. Welcome back, both of you.
Hello.
Glad to be here.
Steve, this is the 50th, I'm sorry, the 50th, this is the 15th, the 15th anniversary of your blog. And you sent us the very first piece that you wrote, and it's actually still topical. Tell us about that.
Yeah, this was from August 2nd, 2003, the early days of the Iraq War. And sad to say, reading it, it's a case of the more things change, the more things remain the same. The headline from this post back in 2003 was "Undercounting of Deaths in Iraq Gets Worse." And it was about an MSNBC article, and it starts, "The soldier," this is a quote from the MSNBC article, "the soldier killed late Friday was the 52nd to die in combat in Iraq since President Bush declared major fighting over on May 1st. So far, 167 soldiers have died in the Iraq War, 20 more than the 1991 Gulf War. This was, as I said, the early days. The final death toll in the Iraq War for American soldiers exceeded 4,400. I won't read the rest of the post verbatim, but what it says, it points out so many errors which continue to this day. First of all, the use of they talk about 50, this was the 52nd soldier to die since a certain date. That gives people the idea that the number is very low. Really, the number that is relevant was 167, but even that number was a lie because the 167 was the number of deaths in combat. And there's lots of other deaths in war that are characterized often dubiously as accidents. So the real death toll for the soldiers in the Iraq War as of that date was 251, not 167, a huge undercount. And that's the kind of thing we continue to see to this day. And the other thing we continue to see to this day is they talk about, again, 167 soldiers, which was really 251, but that was just American soldiers. They don't say that because implicitly they discount the deaths of the Iraqi soldiers who had died, not to mention the Iraqi insurgents who had died, the British soldiers, Polish soldiers, Australian soldiers, and so on. So for the U.S. media, it was a case then, and it still is the case now. Only U.S. lives matter, and it's unfortunate to see that.
Yeah, and when you look at, when you include the Americans, the U.S. soldiers who died, maybe not directly as a result of combat, but let's say the truck they were driving into a war zone tipped over and thus it's an accident, or the private contractors, a.k.a. mercenaries who died, it was well over 5,000 who died, 31,000 who were officially wounded. And the numbers of people who did not die, who were only wounded and didn't die, was exponentially lower than, say, the Vietnam War, because battlefield medicine is so more advanced for a country like the United States. But these are people who had injuries that were life-changing injuries and would have actually resulted in their deaths in Vietnam, except now they could rush them so they have no legs or missing legs and a missing arm or serious brain injuries, still alive. And then the other thing, the Lancet Medical Journal, the British medical journal, very prestigious, estimated that the number of Iraqis who died, who would not have otherwise died if it had not been for the U.S.-British invasion, could be around 1 million or more. So that's the Lancet Medical Journal. Again, as Steve Pat is saying, you know, those are exceptionally high numbers, and it's not even a blip in the U.S. media.
Right. And not only the categories that you just mentioned are not counted, but also soldiers come home and commit suicide. They come home and are homeless and die on the streets of, you know, freezing to death. They come home and kill their wives. So there's all sorts of other deaths which are really directly attributable to the Iraq War or to any war that we want to talk about, which they simply just don't include when they talk about the death tolls in these wars.
Let's go to a different story. I'm looking at the worst and most disgusting. There's a number of them, Steve, that you've submitted. Let's start first with the Florida teacher. Go ahead, read that headline to us.
Yeah, this was just a classic capitalist story. Florida teacher quits to become full-time grocery shopper and doubles his salary. So this is a country which claims we value our kids and value our teachers, but of course we don't. And this is really a good indication of that. This guy spent 20 years teaching, and the whole time he was working a second job to make ends meet. Finally, he just decided he'd go be a full-time grocery shopper. It's just a sad indication of the values our society has.
So the headline is disgusting, but it's really the story is disgusting.
The story is awful. I read a similar story just recently saying that a teacher in Texas quit because she was making more money buying junked auto parts in junkyards and selling them on eBay than she was making as a teacher.
My mom's been a high school teacher for 35 years, and you know, she's an art teacher. They don't ever get a budget. She gets zero money, no money for anything. How do you do anything art related without a budget? You can't. I mean, so she fundraises on her own, private fundraising, to be able to get anything for the kids.
And you can see why we, Steve, are having this wave of strikes in so-called red states, Oklahoma, West Virginia, Arizona. But you're right. I mean, it's really, it says so much about this country and its priorities that teachers can't make a living wage. Let's go on to another headline in the worst and the most disgusting. This is about someone who could not afford the ambulance. Go ahead.
It's again, capitalism in a nutshell. Health. This is healthcare rather than teaching. Black mom collapses, ambulance won't help because she's uninsured, now she's dead. And the story, the headline really says it all, but just to elaborate a bit, this woman, you know, they called an ambulance and the EMS drivers got there and started arguing because she didn't have insurance and they couldn't cover her. They finally agreed to carry her downstairs to her mother's car, but by the time they, you know, got her into the mother's car and got her to the hospital, she was dead. And she had had a stroke, and most people know, I think, that time, when you have a stroke, time is of the essence. If you can't spend time arguing with a driver of the ambulance about whether you have insurance or not, if you do, your chances of death go up, you know, immensely. And it's just not something you want to do and not something you would do in any sane society, which had health care for all, which we don't.
I mean, this is why the Hippocratic Oath exists, right? I mean, you have to take care of people when they're sick. And I'm sure EMS drivers don't have to take that oath, but it is, I mean, that is just a requirement of humanity.
Steve Pat, let's go real quick to the Facebook ad. I can't find it right in front of me, but the New York Times a couple days ago, when Facebook shut down 32 pages, it wasn't really 32 pages, 17 of them were profiles, but they said it was Facebook, I guess, had testified in Congress that it was a shadowy conspiracy. So the front page above the fold of the New York Times says, "Shadowy Facebook reveals shadowy conspiracy that jolts America," or something like that. I mean, I was like, really? 32 pages? Well, 17 of them were profiles?
Yeah. It's.
Were you jolted?
I was not jolted. The latest, the story yesterday from the people who testified on behalf of the administration talked about a pervasive campaign consisting of, you know, 32 Facebook pages and 7 Instagram accounts, all of which, most of the Facebook pages had no followers or fewer than 10 followers, and the Instagram accounts had no followers, but they described this as pervasive.
Well, let me ask John Kiriakou, because he was in the CIA. John, shadowy conspiracy? Did you feel jolted?
Please, no. You know, I'm always amazed at some of the words that are used in these titles in publications that are supposed to be publications of record, right? People base their PhD dissertations on the New York Times and the Washington Post and the Wall Street Journal. I never really thought about some of these headlines until we started doing this segment. And then I realized how ridiculous and how misleading so many of them are.
So you weren't jolted.
He wasn't jolted.
No, I wasn't jolted. No.
We have 1 minute left. I want to go to a let's at least have one funny headline. I'm worried about the Crows. I'm more worried about the Ravens.
The Baltimore
actually.
Ravens?
Go ahead, Steve.
You know, people know I'm a bird watcher, so this headline definitely appealed to me. And the headline from the National Geographic, a very serious journal, reads, "Crows are always jerks to ravens, research confirms." So, darn those crows.
Who funded that? I mean, that was obviously a pro-Raven lobby was behind that
study. We got to get this bird money out of politics, man. This is too much.
Why are crows jerks to ravens? What's going on? I can't tell them apart.
I can't either. I know we have more crows around here than ravens.
Well, I can give you a long lesson on that someday. But
Steve is a bird watcher. He's like a pro.
Everybody knows.
He also runs like 100-mile races and watches birds. In addition to that, that's why he doesn't have that much time. He ekes out a little time from running these super marathons and bird watching to do this segment about headlines, the worst, the most misleading, or the funniest headlines. We'll have to come back to Steve next week, John.
Joining us from the San Francisco Bay Area was Steve Pat. He's an independent journalist whose critiques of the mainstream media have been a feature of his blog, Left Eye on the News. Steve tweets at Left Eye Blog, with I being the letter I. And you can check out the stories that we couldn't get to on the blog. And we were joined in studio by Sputnik News producer Nicole Russell. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We're completely out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook, and you can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes, at iHeartRadio, and now at Spotify. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear.